On today's Please Explain segment, we're continuing our series within a series, Please Explain How to Save the World. And today's topic is our planet's human population and how to understand population growth, population control, and what they all may mean to the fate of the Earth. Our guests are Hania Zlotnik, the director of the Population Division at the Department of Economics and Social Affairs at the United Nations, and Dr. Joel E. Cohn, a mathematical biologist and the head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University and Columbia University. He's the author of How Many People Can the Earth Support? Welcome to our show, and please explain. And by the way, for our listeners, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692 to join in the discussion, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's begin with you, Joel. I understand that as many as 1 billion people are on Earth right now who do not have enough food or water. It's difficult not to be overwhelmed by that number, so it's hard to know even where to begin this conversation. But help us go back to the beginning of the problem, as we try to do, and please explain. When did our planet's population begin to overwhelm our resources?
That's a good question. If you read the books of the Bible, the children of Jacob left the land they were in because of a widespread famine. And in almost every culture, there are documents of localized famines going back thousands of years. In the Gilgamesh epics, there are talks about too many people on the earth. But many, many modern scientists would put a significant date around 1960, when the 3 billion people on the earth equaled the capacity of subsistence agriculture to feed people. And I think that's a reasonable modern date to say that we entered a new era. That was a time when people were predicting massive starvation for the future and chaos. And what actually happened was that there was a green revolution and the invention of contraception. And so, in fact, what's happened in the last half century since 1960 has been an enormous increase in population, more than doubling from 3 billion to 7 billion, a dramatic drop in the number of children per woman from nearly 5 to about 2.5, and an enormous increase in agricultural production, which has raised the average amount of food per person, but has not reached the poorest billion people who are chronically hungry. In addition to those chronically hungry, there are a couple more billion who are malnourished. They don't get enough protein, vitamins, and iron and other essential minerals. So it's a mixed picture. There's good news. We had the Green Revolution. Good news, about half of women in unions have modern contraception. Bad news, enormous inequality in incomes. Half the world lives on less than $2 a day. A billion are chronically hungry. We've got a very mixed picture.
Well, you're talking about more recent developments, but Thomas Malthus was already predicting dire consequences centuries ago. Can you explain his ideas and how they inform some of our thinking about population growth and limits to growth today?
Well, Malthus was trained as a mathematics student at the University of Cambridge. He was a minister of the church. And he said, look at the American colonies. They are doubling every 25 years. He got his data from Ben Franklin and other people in the colonies. And he said, so human population tends to grow exponentially under good conditions. But, he said, our food production only grows linearly, sort of an increase in land area every year, which just increases a certain amount of food that we can take off the land. He assumed that the amount of food you could get per area of land was constant. So if you draw a diagonally increasing line and an exponentially increasing line, the exponentially increasing line is going to go up faster than the diagonally increasing line. And he said, mankind is doomed to constant recurrences of massive hunger, poverty, starvation, and problems.
Now, Hania, following up on that, what parts of the world are most stressed and why? Is the problem of overpopulation more an issue in urban or in rural areas?
Well, the way we see the world, and it's what made news at the time we were commemorating that the world population had passed the 7 billion mark, is that the world today is divided into three groups of countries. There are 42% of the population of the world lives in countries that have such a low fertility that their generations are not replacing themselves. So their populations eventually will start declining, becoming smaller. We have another 40% where the fertility of the people in those countries has declined quite a bit. It has more than halved. They're still expected to grow, but not too fast. And then we have only 18% of the world population that coincides more or less with the bottom billion, but not exactly, where the fertility of the countries is still very high and every generation is going to grow by at least 50%, sometimes more. Now, most of these countries are in sub-Saharan Africa, but not all. We have countries with relatively high fertility and high potential for continued population growth in Asia, especially in southern Asia, and also in Latin America. So they're still in the developing world. They do not constitute today the largest part of the population. They're about 1.2 billion, but they tend to be the poorest countries, and partly it is because of the vicious circle of poverty, lack of access to services, lack higher child mortality, lower education, and lower access to methods of contraception, that these populations are having too many children and are continuing in this cycle of maintenance of poverty.
Well, as you both pointed out, we passed the 7 billion mark in October. And how fast is the world's population growing at this time?
At around 1% per year, which historically is an extraordinary rate. The highest rate that the world population grew at was around 2% per year in the late 60s. So we have half the rate of population growth in about 40 years. But at this rate of growth, the population would still increase enormously if it doesn't continue to drop. So the big message we have at the United Nations is that the rate of world population growth needs to continue declining to try to achieve something that may be sustainable population growth in the future.
Now, Joel, although we have a relatively low growth rate in the United States, don't we consume far more of the Earth's resources than people in most other countries?
Yes, indeed.
So do populations of countries with high birth rates tend to consume less? Or are we just an anomaly?
Countries with high growth rates, as Hania just indicated, are among the poorest in the world and have much less access to energy per person, and in general don't have the means to consume what we in the United States and the rich countries of Europe and Asia are able to consume. So there is almost, not quite, but an inverse association between energy consumption and population growth rate.
Now, I was surprised to learn that in our country, an estimated 50% of all pregnancies are unintended. Can that be right in a country where we have access to reproductive health and family planning information and to birth control?
The number I have is about 48%, and yes, it can be right, because a lot of people don't take the necessary precautions, and there are a lot of incentives to prevent the education of young people in schools as to how to prevent pregnancies, and there are a lot of barriers to making the means of prevention available to young people. there was a panel that recommended to the FDA that emergency contraception be made available over-the-counter to young people, and that, for political reasons, was nixed. In this respect, as in many others, the United States is above average. In the United States, 48% of pregnancies are unplanned, which means either mistimed or not wanted at any time. And in the world as a whole, it's down around 41%. So here we are outstanding, and we ought to get over it and educate our people to take care of the fact of creating life. It's an act of great responsibility, not to be done casually.
Well, you mentioned the political aspect of this. This has become a hot-button political issue in our country, with a number of candidates promising to defund organizations like Planned Parenthood. Should the state have any say in how many children we have? Is this something that is culturally something that's really more a matter of culture than a matter of politics?
Well, the state already plays a large role in how many children we have. It provides subsidies for education, which reduce the cost. On the other hand, it doesn't give mothers Social Security credit for staying home and taking care of their children. So it encourages people to have children but doesn't want them to take care of them through its economic incentives. There is certainly no role for the kind of coercion that was practiced in China under the one-child policy, but many governments of democracies have incentives, both explicit and implicit, to encourage or discourage childbearing.
Now,
the French have been trying to get more children by giving child allowances with very little effect.
They're trying to encourage people to have children.
Yes.
Whereas in Hanya, as Joel pointed out, China had this one-child policy, and people around the world were horrified. But did they see it as an economic and social necessity?
Well, the case of China is always brought up to try to suggest that it is forceful state intervention that has been behind the reduction of fertility in the world. And the truth of the matter is that very often states either are indifferent to what's happening in terms of fertility or haven't really had measures of a similar type as the ones that China imposed. China was very explicit when they decided to go strongly into family planning that they wanted to reduce population growth because they had been experiencing very slow economic growth, and they had lots of experience in disasters that were that caused massive deaths. So yes, they wanted to do it in a very explicit way to have their economy grow better. But most other countries where fertility has declined, very often it has done it in cases where the government has no explicit policy about population, where the government doesn't even support necessarily the access to contraception, and it is the people that have wanted and seen the benefit of having fewer children, and therefore they have reduced their fertility. In very poor countries, the role of government is often very important. One of these cases is Bangladesh, where the level of education of people was very low when fertility started declining, where access to health wasn't all that good. But the government developed a very forceful program, forceful in the sense of putting lots of effort in reaching women who have just given birth to do two things, helping them to care better for the babies they had, and second, providing them, if they wanted, access to contraception to space the next birth and eventually to stop having children. And it has worked very well because Bangladesh, though still one of the least developed countries, is a country that has reduced its fertility level by half.
My guests are Hanya Zlotnik, Director of the Population Division at the Department of Economics and Social Affairs at the United Nations, and Dr. Joel E. Cohn, a mathematical biologist and the head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University and Columbia University. his book, How Many People Can the Earth Support? This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Hanya, you're mentioning Bangladesh. Reminds me that my sister actually worked for the UN in Bangladesh in the 1970s, not long after the country became independent. And she had to contend with some pretty basic misconceptions, like flour and water are not a good replacement for breast milk when you're nursing a child. She said that she was fighting all sorts of basic cultural misconceptions in trying to get people to consider birth control or just how to keep their child healthy. Is that kind of ignorance common around the world?
We have a lot of evidence that that's exactly the case, especially in populations that are still have very low levels of education, and where the mothers that are having the children now are not likely to get educated during their lifetimes. However, this element of training them about how to take care of their children, that's the first thing they want to do because they're all interested in having their children survive. And at the same time, dispelling myths about what contraception can do for them and how to use it is very important because that empowers women and eventually couples to make rational decisions about when to have children and how many to have. And the history of the decline of fertility is that, of course, the numbers of children don't drop from one day to the next from 5 to 2, but as the one generation reduces the number of children by 1 or 2, the next one does it by more, and eventually, even if not everyone gets to study at university, all levels of the population see the benefit of having fewer children so that families can invest more in each. And the investment is in education, investment in health, investment in other aspects that give the child more human capital to produce more in the future.
Now, I've read in this country, I'm not sure if it's a majority, but a lot of teens believe that you can't get pregnant the first time you have sex. So this is not just a third world problem.
No, because precisely that's one of the reasons that population issues are so controversial, because we cannot talk about population without talking about something that is very sensitive, and it's about sex and it's about reproduction. And at the beginning of the contraceptive revolution and when the United Nations validated the involvement of governments in facilitating access to contraception, everyone was discussing whether it was valid for the government to be introduced in the bedroom. That's the way they put it. It's not that that's what's happening, but certainly trying to educate people on what is responsible sexual behavior is not easy. Even parents, and sometimes educated parents, have difficulty talking to their children about these issues. So the society itself has to take some responsibility to teach these aspects of human life in an objective way and in a systematic way through the schooling system. And not many countries are doing that.
Joe, Mike from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Mike.
Hi.
From Queens, I'm sorry.
Yes, Queens, that's very important to me.
Okay. Go ahead.
I had a question on something that you touched on, talking about more developed countries. And I've read a couple of articles on Japan and some Western European countries having a negative population crisis where they're not refreshing fast enough. I was just wondering if that's a sensationalist kind of writing, if it really can be called a crisis. Are they going to lose their population 3 or 4 centuries or something like that? And in such a case, should the government do something about it? I mean, for example, American politicians running on family values, is that actually a more in-depth issue?
Okay. Joel, you want to tackle it first?
Well, I believe there are more than 50 countries with negative rates of population growth. And they are among the 42% of the world population that Hanya described as having low fertility. Whether that is a crisis depends on your choice of words and also depends on the rate of population decline. A slow decline can be coped with, does not indicate that 200 or 300 years from now, those countries will no longer exist any more than a 60-mile-an-hour reading on my speedometer means that 1 hour from now, I will be exactly 60 miles further down the road. It doesn't work like that. Societies adapt and change.
Isn't one of the big problems in a country like Japan that people are living longer? So the death rate has slowed down at the same time that the birth rate has slowed down.
I would call that a great success, not a problem. Japan has the longest life expectancy in the world, and most people who get to participate in long life rather like it.
I prefer to the alternative myself.
But yeah, right. So I consider the long life to be a great achievement. In fact, life expectancy worldwide, which is around 70 years, has tripled in historical times, and that's a great achievement. But we were talking about low fertility. Many governments try to intervene. The Japanese government is trying to encourage people to have children. But that, as in the countries with high fertility, a large part depends on the status and possibilities for women. In countries with high fertility, in many cases, women do not have viable alternatives to childbearing and staying home for cultural reasons. And in countries with low fertility, they may not feel the possibility, the incentives to have children. The incentives may be against them. There may not be places to live separately. They may feel that it's a sexist society. And there are lots of reasons, cultural reasons, on both sides. I personally don't see this as a crisis, but as a success. Look, Kanye said we're growing at 1% a year. That means a doubling time of 69 or 70 years. That means we're at 7 billion. If we double in 70 years, that means by 2080, we'd have 14 billion people on the planet. We can't do that and still have a decent quality of life for most of those people. So the decline in fertility is a huge achievement, as is the increasing length of life. Now, the question is, how do we cope with our successes? That's the question we have to face. Not a crisis, but something that requires urgent attention, education of young people on what sex means, the emotional aspects of sex, the technical aspects of sex, the health aspects of sex, and getting people to value children for quality, not for quantity.
Now, Hanya, has the United Nations looked into whether men and women think differently about these issues in different parts of the world?
Well, in the places where lots of studies have been done because fertility remains high, they tend to coincide in terms of their desires. Very often people are asked about how many children they would like to have, and in places where fertility remains high, both of them want big numbers of children, with men tending to want more than women. There have also been some studies in Europe asking people how many children they want to have, and I think both men and women tend to hover around 2 children, which would be a very good number because that ensures the replacement of populations. The problem that the developed countries have been having, if it's a problem, is that people do not seem to be getting actually the number of children they say they desire. But contrary to the perceptions of 10 years ago when fertility was declining in these countries that already had very low fertility, over the last decade we have seen that the fertility is increasing very, very slowly, but in many of these low fertility countries the bottom has been reached and fertility is going up. So our projections do not show that these countries are going to keep on declining forever, because we are assuming, at least in our central projection, that the fertility is going to keep on going up towards the 2 children per woman, and that essentially slows down the decline of the population. And if that happens, the future for these countries is good. It does demand adaptation, because thanks to the decline of fertility and to increasing longevity, the populations are going to change very much in structure. You will have a lot more older people, but healthier people than in previous generations. And it's important that societies start making sure that we remain active longer, that we can work for longer, because the weight of the population is going to shift from a relatively youngish population to an older population. But again, all that is all for the betterment of humanity as a whole, and for the betterment of people, individuals specifically. And that's the change that one expects in every country of the world. And that is actually happening now at relatively fast speeds in most of the developing world.
Today's Please Explain segment is the second in a series that we've begun. Please explain how to save the world. We're talking about population growth, and whether it does suggest that we'll have some very serious problems down the road. Our guests are Hanya Zlotnik, Director of the Population Division at the Department of Economics and Social Affairs at the United Nations, and Dr. Joel E. Cohen, author of How Many People Can the Earth Support? He is a mathematical biologist and the head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University and Columbia University. Our number here, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And we are back with today's Please Explain. We're trying to save the world, and we're looking at population growth, population control, with two experts, Dr. Joel E. Cohen of Rockefeller University, Columbia University, and Hanya Zlotnik of the United Nations. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's go to Joel. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Always a fascinating topic through most of my life. It seems like we've been talking about this. And I have to pose a question here, and probably no answer, but with people that are so involved with it for their careers on population explosions, and that we've seen that religion can trump education, and religion can certainly trump any kind of a government, whether you're talking in the Middle East or even in the United States, for cures to population explosion or population problems are overwhelming that. And then one of the how do we take on the ancient and current religions that want for people to propagate more than ever before?
You want to begin, Hanya?
Yes. Demographers posed themselves this question a long time ago, because it seemed a simple solution, saying, well, different religions will have different responses to the population issue. And the truth of the matter is, we have found over the years that religion is not a very important determinant, as we call it, of reproductive behavior. Take simple examples. Italy, the most Catholic country of Europe, has had very low fertility, extremely low fertility for now 20 years, and no matter what the government is doing or what the Vatican is preaching, fertility is not going up again to 2 or 3 children per woman. In the Muslim world, there's the misperception that being Muslim also means having lots of children. Well, a country like Tunisia, where the recent revolution started, has had below replacement fertility again for 15 years or more. In fact, for every religion one mentions, there's a huge, the whole spectrum of human behavior in terms of reproduction can be found among the people who practice that religion. That implies that it is not religion that is determining the behavior of people. It is other aspects of their lives, very much tied to how societies in general behave, and also what incentives or disincentives they have economically, or even in terms of their desires for what the future generation should have.
What about agricultural societies? It was always my sense that that in many agricultural societies, people wanted to have a lot of kids because it meant that they'd get more help on the farm.
Well, it depends, because the first people who to reduce their fertility were living in agricultural societies in Europe. And part of the reason that we give for their wanting to have fewer children, and at that time it was even when child mortality was high, is that the rules of inheritance in these agricultural societies benefited just the oldest person. The other ones didn't have a possibility of inheriting the land, because the more they divided the land, the less interest there was in the land, the less they could produce. So these rules of inheritance prompted families to have fewer children, and that's where in France, the fertility started declining among essentially the people in the rural areas because of these rules of inheritance. Now, if there's another society that is still very agricultural where they have another type of rule, it might happen that that's not prompting them to have fewer children. But it is not just being agricultural that matters. And with the fact today that in order to be most productive in agriculture, you have to have fewer people working the land, in general, if one is modern, this won't help to promote high fertility.
For example, in the United States, fertility has fallen since the Civil War, and some people attribute the decline beginning after the Civil War to the mechanization of agriculture in the United States, which reduced the need for a large number of children to do the work by hand. But the fact is that the decline in the U.S. did begin shortly after the Civil War and without any government policies whatsoever.
An exception is the Amish, who continue to have a lot of children and resist a lot of mechanization.
Right, resist all kinds of changes.
Let's go now to Dan from Manhattan. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. It seems to me that it'd be interesting if the guests could address the issue of migration as part of population growth. You just mentioned that the U.S. population growth rate or the fertility started to decline after the Civil War, but our population has continued to increase. And one explanation I've heard has been increasing migration and the fact that some of the immigrant groups that come have initially higher fertility. And this has also been true in parts of Europe.
Hanya Zlotnik is the world's authority on migration.
Go, Hanya.
We usually don't discuss migration too much in relation to population growth, because for the countries that are growing very fast, they would have to be sending out too many migrants to reduce their population growth. So reduction of population growth usually does not happen because of migration, or at least not in very significant ways. But what is true now is for the countries that are not growing, that may even be declining because of excess of deaths over births, migration is making a very important contribution, either on reversing that excess, that means the population is growing mostly because of migration, or at least reducing the negative growth that the excess of deaths over births produces. That is happening very much in Europe. Their growth rates of European countries are not as low as they would be, precisely because they're having migration. Now, yes, it is true that at the early stage of the migration, very often the migrants have relatively higher fertility than the locals, but the convergence of the fertility of the migrants to the locals is done very fast. And part of the fact that the migrants are having more children in numbers relative to their numbers is because they arrive young, so they're more likely to be at the ages where they reproduce than the normal population. So migration helps population grow when the populations that receive migrants, both because of the numbers of migrants they receive and because of the second effect of their fertility. but it doesn't last all that long. And the U.S. is the biggest example of the impact of migration because it's the main receiver of migrants in the whole world. And it's a country that was built by migration and continues to be built by migration. And it's very difficult to make generalizations about the migrants because essentially the U.S. receives migrants from every corner of the world. And there are many cultures that mix themselves up here and very quickly become American.
Now, Joel, what about another kind of migration, the migration of people from rural areas to urban centers? The cities are growing. Does that have an impact on population growth?
Absolutely, it does. It's anticipated that the rural population of the world will grow very slowly or not at all through the rest of the century and even decline after mid-century, but the urban population is expected roughly to double between 2000 and 2050, mainly in cities of rather small size. More than half of the population with urban population will live in cities of under 500,000, not in the megacities. This is equivalent in the developing countries to adding a city of 1 million people every 5 days for the next several decades. And when people are in cities, the incentives for having large numbers of children are much lower because you have to house them and the opportunities for schooling, for access to contraception, for health care generally, and for productive employment are much better than in rural areas. That's why people are voting with their feet to go to the cities worldwide. And that will bring a lowering of fertility.
And you mentioned earlier that the more educated people are, the less likely they have a lot of children.
Yes.
Why is that?
That's a good question, and demographers don't have a real causal answer. It could be that education gives people alternatives, job opportunities, helps them get access to contraception, and permits them to take more control over their lives.
But they'd be more likely to be able to afford having more children.
Exactly. There could also be a sort of a third factor, like wealth, that lets people get educated and favors having fewer children. So, because you want to invest more in each child. So education affects fertility. People who get pregnant in high school used to be forced to drop out of school altogether. Fertility can impede higher education. We know that in Norway, that women who have children early do not go on for advanced degrees as often as those who defer having their children. And there are third factors. But it's one of the clearest patterns in demography. In every country, the more educated women have fewer children per lifetime. They start having children later, and their children survive better. Their children die less. They have a lower death rate, and they do better.
Dr. Joel E. Cohen is a mathematical biologist, the head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University and Columbia University, and author of How Many People Can the Earth Support? And Hanya Zlotnik is the director of the Population Division at the Department of Economics and Social Affairs at the United Nations. Thank you both so much.